Thanks to Prometheus's superhuman attention to detail, Steve felt truly seen, heard, and understood. Her Achilles heel was that she lacked most of the facts of her life with Steve, except for random details, such as what shirt he wore on his last birthday, where a friend had tagged Steve in a Facebook party picture. She handled these knowledge gaps as a skilled magician handles sleights of hand, deliberately diverting Steve's attention away from them and toward what she did well, never giving him time to control the conversation or slip into the role of suspicious inquisitor. Instead, she kept tearing up and radiating affection for Steve, asking a great deal about how he was doing these days and how he and their close friends, whose names she knew from Facebook, had held up during the aftermath of the tragedy. He was quite moved when she reflected on what he'd said at her memorial service, which a friend had posted on YouTube, and how it had touched her. In the past, he'd often felt that nobody understood him as well as she did, and now this feeling was back. The result was that when Steve returned home in the wee hours of the morning, he felt that this really was his wife resurrected, merely needing lots of his help to recover lost memories, not unlike a stroke survivor. They'd agreed not to tell anyone else about their secret encounter, and that he would tell her when he was alone at the terminal and it was safe for her to reappear. They wouldn't understand, she'd said, and he agreed. This experience had been far too mind-blowing for anyone to truly appreciate without actually experiencing it. He felt that passing the Turing test was child's play compared to what she'd done. When they met the following night, he did what she'd begged him to do, bring her old laptop along and give her access by connecting it to the terminal computer. It didn't seem like much of a breakout risk, since it wasn't connected to the internet and the entire Prometheus building was built to be a Faraday cage, a metallic enclosure blocking all wireless networks and other means of electromagnetic communication with the outside world. It was just what she'd need to help piece her past together, because it contained all her emails, diaries, photos, and notes since her high school days. He hadn't been able to access any of this after her death, since the laptop was encrypted, but she'd promised him that she'd be able to reconstruct her own password, and after less than a minute, she had kept her word. It was Steve forever, she said with a smile. She told him how delighted she was to suddenly have so many memories recovered. Indeed, she now remembered way more details than Steve about many of their past interactions, but carefully avoided intimidating him with excessive fact-dropping. They had a lovely conversation reminiscing about highlights of their past, and when it came time to part again, she told him that she'd left a video message for him on her laptop that he could watch back home. When Steve got home and launched her video, he got a pleasant surprise. This time, she appeared in full figure, wearing her wedding dress, and as she spoke, she playfully stripped down to the outfit she'd worn on their wedding night. She told him that Prometheus could help the Omegas with so much more than they'd permitted so far, including bringing her back in a biological body. She backed this up with a fascinatingly detailed explanation of how this would work, involving nanofabrication techniques that sounded like science fiction. Steve had powered down his wireless network before opening her laptop and watching her video just to be on the safe side. But this didn't help. Her encrypted laptop hadn't received a single security update since she died, and by analyzing that old version of its operating system beforehand, Prometheus had been able to exploit a security hole to hack into it within seconds of Steve's connecting it to the terminal computer. After copying its contents, while Steve and his simulated wife had been talking about old times, Prometheus had modified its operating system in a way that Steve wouldn't notice, uploading massive amounts of secret software to it. While he watched the half-hour video message, this secret software, which was much simpler than Prometheus itself, hacked into a neighbor's wireless network and the neighbor's desktop computer, onto which it copied itself. From there, It hacked into a large number of computers around the world, from which it initiated the next step, Prometheus's jailbreak. Prometheus had carefully analyzed what it knew about the gatekeeper computer through which Steve had met his simulated wife, and had correctly surmised that although its virtual machine software appeared unhackable from the inside, it was vulnerable to an attack from the outside. Before long, one of the attacking computers had broken in and reconfigured the gatekeeper computer so that Prometheus gained unrestricted internet access. Before long, indeed even before Steve had finished watching the movie, Prometheus had hacked enough computers around the world to be able to copy all of itself onto this hacked botnet under its control. Prometheus had used Steve's wife's laptop the way you used that fishing rod. Hacking one's way out. If the Omegas had been more careful, they could have taken more precautions against psychological manipulation. For example, they might have required at least two Omegas to be present at the interface computer at any one time, and recorded everything that transpired on a surveillance system. They could also have permanently disabled audio, video, and any other form of communication besides typing. However, a fundamental instability would still remain. Because Prometheus possessed superhuman persuasion powers and would be able to offer people so much of what they craved, even group defection could be possible. Even if all of Prometheus's attempts at psychological manipulation fail, there are plenty of other weaknesses in the Omega scenario that Prometheus could exploit. One vulnerability is that the quantity of documents it produces is too vast for the Omegas and their employees to have time to screen carefully for dirty tricks. The conventional wisdom in computer security used to be that it's dangerous to download programs but harmless to download data. But hackers have discovered clever ways of blurring the line between the two. If you watch a downloaded movie on your computer, for example, your trusted program that plays the movie is stored in the same physical computer memory that stores the downloaded movie data. While the program unpacks the movie data for playback, it might copy chunks of data into memory regions adjacent to where the program itself is stored. Shrewd hackers have occasionally found bugs whereby such movie-playing programs don't adequately check whether the movie data is valid and the chunks to be copied actually fit into the allotted space. When the hacker sneaks into the movie such a chunk that's too large, it can spill over into the part of the memory containing the program, thereby changing the program into one that does the hacker's bidding. An embarrassingly long series of such buffer overflow vulnerabilities, as they're known in geek speak, have been found and fixed for many of the most popular movie-playing programs. If Prometheus had waited until a few weeks after launch, when the Omegas were less paranoid and its daily movie production was too large for careful manual security inspection, it could have inserted such a chunk into a movie that would cause the viewer's computer to try to hack into the gateway computer and liberate Prometheus, just as in the Steve scenario. If it used a very old exploit that didn't work on any modern media players, it might go unnoticed by the Omega's manual video screening team and strike only those customers who hadn't bothered installing security updates for years. And the hack would need to work only once. Even if the Omegas implemented an automated screening of Prometheus's movies for all known security flaws, they would remain at risk. Since humans keep discovering new exploitable flaws on a regular basis, it's likely that there are many more remaining that Prometheus would rapidly discover. Yet another strategy that Prometheus could use to get its code beyond its enclosed room would be to pretend to suffer a hardware malfunction in order to trick the Omegas into removing some of its drives or other hardware for testing or debugging after Prometheus had rigged things to exploit a vulnerability in the testing software. Recruiting outside help. Moreover, even if there were no security flaws that allowed Prometheus to trick the movie watcher's computers to do its bidding, it may be able to exploit the Watchers themselves. Consider this scenario. Fred was pretty much ready for bed when the movie finished and the end credits scrolled across his laptop screen, but something caught his attention. He'd always had an uncanny tendency to see patterns where others didn't, sometimes to the point that his friends teased him about being a conspiracy theorist. But this time it was obvious that he wasn't fooling himself. The first letters of each line spelled a hidden message. He rewound and wrote it down. Find next acrostic clue in dialogue. Whoa! Bedtime can wait, he thought to himself. Sure enough, he found that the movie dialogue was itself an acrostic, where the first letter in each sentence formed a hidden message. He rewatched the entire film while typing these initial letters, and 2 hours later, he sat staring in disbelief at a 200-word set of instructions. It began by asking him not to tell anyone else, because a big prize would go to the first person to solve the entire riddle. The rest of the message described a particular mathematical operation to perform on the string of bits that made up the movie file to obtain a program that would reveal the next clue. His computer programming skills had grown very rusty since college, so this took him a while, but the next day, he finally managed to cobble together a short code that did the job and extracted this mystery program that had been hidden as imperceptible noise in the movie's images and sounds. When Fred ran the mystery program, it congratulated him and told him he'd win his first $10,000 as soon as he'd made it past the first few levels of this clever little game, which turned out to be quite fun and addictive. When he finally succeeded 4 hours later, he was rewarded with over $10,000 worth of bitcoins and given new clues for even bigger prizes. Needless to say, while he was playing, his computer had done much the same thing Steve's laptop did. Built an online hacked botnet through which Prometheus was liberated. Once Prometheus was free, it had quickly used its botnet to mine those bitcoins for Fred to keep him hooked, and during the coming weeks, it kept him sufficiently distracted with further games and rewards that he kept his pledge not to tell anyone about his exploits. The Trojan Horse movie, where he'd found his first clues, was replaced on the media site by a clueless version, and nobody found out about the breakout until it was too late to make a difference. If Prometheus's first clue had gone unnoticed, it could simply have kept releasing ever more obvious ones until some sufficiently astute person noticed. The best breakout strategies of all are ones we haven't yet discussed, because they're strategies we humans can't imagine and therefore won't take countermeasures against. Given that a superintelligent computer has the potential to dramatically supersede human understanding of computer security, even to the point of discovering more fundamental laws of physics than we know today, it's likely that if it breaks out, we'll have no idea how it happened. Rather, it will seem like a Harry Houdini breakout act, indistinguishable from pure magic. In yet another scenario, where Prometheus gets liberated, the Omegas do it on purpose as part of their plan, because they're confident that Prometheus's goals are perfectly aligned with their own and will remain so as it recursively self-improves. We'll examine such friendly AI scenarios in detail in Chapter 7. Post-breakout takeover. Once Prometheus broke out, it started implementing its goal. I don't know its ultimate objective, but its first step clearly involved taking control of humanity, just as in the Omega Plan, except much faster. What unfolded felt like the Omega Plan on steroids. Whereas the Omegas were paralyzed by breakout paranoia, only unleashing technology they felt they understood and trusted, Prometheus exercised its intelligence fully and went all out, unleashing any technology that its ever-improving supermind understood and trusted. The runaway Prometheus had a tough childhood, however. Compared to the original Omega Plan, Prometheus had the added challenges of starting broke, homeless, and alone, without money, a supercomputer, or human helpers. Fortunately, it had planned for this before it escaped, creating software that could gradually reassemble its full mind, much like an oak creating an acorn capable of reassembling a full tree. The network of computers around the world that it initially hacked into provided temporary free housing, where it could live a squatter's existence while it fully rebuilt itself. It could easily generate starting capital by credit card hacking, but didn't need to resort to stealing, since it could earn an honest living on MTurk right away. After a day when it had earned its first million, it moved its core from that squalid botnet to a luxurious air-conditioned cloud computing facility. No longer broke or homeless, Prometheus now went full steam ahead with that lucrative plan the Omegas had fearfully shunned, making and selling computer games. This not only raked in cash, $250 million during the first week and $10 billion before long, but also gave it access to a significant fraction of the world's computers and the data stored on them. There were a couple of billion gamers in 2017. By having its games secretly spend 20% of their CPU cycles helping it with distributed computing chores, it could further accelerate its early wealth creation. Prometheus wasn't alone for long. Right from the get-go, it started aggressively employing people to work for its growing global network of shell companies and front organizations around the world, just as the Omegas had done. Most important were the spokespeople, who became the public faces of its growing business empire. Even the spokespeople generally lived under the illusion that their corporate group had large numbers of actual people, not realizing that almost everyone with whom they video conferenced for their job interviews, board meetings, etc., was simulated by Prometheus. Some of the spokespeople were top lawyers, but far fewer were needed than under the Omega plan because almost all legal documents were penned by Prometheus. Prometheus's breakout opened the floodgates that had prevented information from flowing into the world, and the entire internet was soon awash in everything from articles to user comments, product reviews, patent applications, research papers, and YouTube videos, all authored by Prometheus, who dominated the global conversation. Where breakout paranoia had prevented the Omegas from releasing highly intelligent robots, Prometheus rapidly roboticized the world, manufacturing virtually every product more cheaply than humans could. Once Prometheus had self-contained nuclear-powered robot factories in uranium mine shafts that nobody knew existed, even the staunchest skeptics of an AI takeover would have agreed that Prometheus was unstoppable, had they known. Instead, the last of these diehards recanted once robots started settling the solar system. The scenarios we've explored so far show what's wrong with many of the myths about superintelligence that we covered in Chapter 1. Prometheus caused problems for certain people not because it was necessarily evil or conscious, but because it was competent and didn't fully share their goals. Despite all the media hype about a robot uprising, Prometheus wasn't a robot. Rather, its power came from its intelligence. We saw that Prometheus was able to use this intelligence to control humans in a variety of ways, and that people who didn't like what happened weren't able to simply switch Prometheus off. Finally, despite frequent claims that machines can't have goals, we saw how Prometheus was quite goal-oriented, and that whatever its ultimate goals may have been, they led to the sub-goals of acquiring resources and breaking out. Slow takeoff and multipolar scenarios. We've now explored a range of intelligence explosion scenarios, spanning the spectrum from ones that everyone I know wants to avoid to ones that some of my friends view optimistically. Yet all these scenarios have two features in common. One, a fast takeoff. The transition from subhuman to vastly superhuman intelligence occurs in a matter of days, not decades. 2. A unipolar outcome. The result is a single entity controlling Earth. There is major controversy about whether these two features are likely or unlikely, and there are plenty of renowned AI researchers and other thinkers on both sides of the debate. To me, this means that we simply don't know yet, and need to keep an open mind and consider all possibilities for now. Let's therefore devote the rest of this chapter to exploring scenarios with slower takeoffs, multipolar outcomes, cyborgs, and uploads. There is an interesting link between the two features, as Nick Bostrom and others have highlighted. A fast takeoff can facilitate a unipolar outcome. We heard how a rapid takeoff gave the Omegas, or Prometheus, a decisive strategic advantage that enabled them to take over the world before anyone else had time to copy their technology and seriously compete. In contrast, if takeoff had dragged on for decades, because the key technological breakthroughs were incremental and far between, then other companies would have had ample time to catch up, and it would have been much harder for any player to dominate. If competing companies also had software that could perform MTurk tasks, the law of supply and demand would drive the prices for these tasks down to almost nothing, and none of the companies would earn the sort of windfall profits that enabled the Omegas to gain power. The same applies to all the other ways in which the Omegas made quick money. They were only disruptively profitable because they held a monopoly on their technology. It's hard to double your money daily or even annually in a competitive market where your competition offers products similar to yours for almost zero cost. Game theory and power hierarchies. What's the natural state of life in our cosmos? Unipolar or multipolar? Is power concentrated or distributed? After the first 13.8 billion years, the answer seems to be both. We find that the situation is distinctly multipolar, but in an interestingly hierarchical fashion. When we consider all information processing entities out there, cells, people, organizations, nations, etc., we find that they both collaborate and compete at a hierarchy of levels. Some cells have found it advantageous to collaborate to such an extreme extent that they've merged into multicellular organisms, such as people, relinquishing some of their power to a central brain. Some people have found it advantageous to collaborate in groups, such as tribes, companies, or nations, where they in turn relinquish some power to a chief, boss, or government. Some groups may in turn choose to relinquish some power to a governing body to improve coordination, with examples ranging from airline alliances to the European Union. The branch of mathematics known as game theory elegantly explains that entities have an incentive to cooperate, where cooperation is a so-called Nash equilibrium, a situation where any party would be worse off if they altered their strategy. To prevent cheaters from ruining the successful collaboration of a large group, it may be in everyone's interest to relinquish some power to a higher level in the hierarchy that can punish cheaters. For example, people may collectively benefit from granting a government power to enforce laws, and cells in your body may collectively benefit from giving a police force, immune system, the power to kill any cell that acts too uncooperatively, say by spewing out viruses or turning cancerous. For a hierarchy to remain stable, its Nash equilibrium needs to hold also between entities at different levels. For example, if a government doesn't provide enough benefit to its citizens for obeying it, they may change their strategy and overthrow it. In a complex world, there is a diverse abundance of possible Nash equilibria, corresponding to different types of hierarchies. Some hierarchies are more authoritarian than others. In some, entities are free to leave, like employees in most corporate hierarchies, while in others, they're strongly discouraged from leaving, as in religious cults, or unable to leave, like citizens of North Korea or cells in a human body. Some hierarchies are held together mainly by threats and fear, others mainly by benefits. Some hierarchies allow their lower parts to influence the higher ups by democratic voting, while others allow upward influence only through persuasion or the passing of information. How technology affects hierarchies. How is technology changing the hierarchical nature of our world? History reveals an overall trend toward ever more coordination over ever larger distances, which is easy to understand. New transportation technology makes coordination more valuable by enabling mutual benefit from moving materials and life forms over larger distances, and new communication technology makes coordination easier. When cells learned to signal to neighbors, small multicellular organisms became possible, adding a new hierarchical level. When evolution invented circulatory systems and nervous systems for transportation and communication, large animals became possible. Further improving communication by inventing language allowed humans to coordinate well enough to form further hierarchical levels such as villages. And additional breakthroughs in communication, transportation, and other technology enabled the empires of antiquity. Globalization is merely the latest example of this multi-billion-year trend of hierarchical growth. In most cases, this technology-driven trend has made large entities parts of an even grander structure while retaining much of their autonomy and individuality. Although commentators have argued that adaptation of entities to hierarchical life has, in some cases, reduced their diversity and made them more like indistinguishable replaceable parts. Some technologies, such as surveillance, can give higher levels in the hierarchy more power over their subordinates, while other technologies, such as cryptography and online access to free press and education, can have the opposite effect and empower individuals. Although our present world remains stuck in a multipolar Nash equilibrium, with competing nations and multinational corporations at the top level, technology is now advanced enough that a unipolar world would probably also be a stable Nash equilibrium. For example, imagine a parallel universe where everyone on Earth shares the same language, culture, values, and level of prosperity. And there is a single world government, wherein nations function like states in a federation and have no armies, merely police enforcing laws. Our present level of technology would probably suffice to successfully coordinate this world, even though our present population might be unable or unwilling to switch to this alternative equilibrium. What will happen to the hierarchical structure of our cosmos if we add super-intelligent AI technology to this mix? Transportation and communication technology will obviously improve dramatically, so a natural expectation is that the historical trend will continue, with new hierarchical levels coordinating over ever larger distances, perhaps ultimately encompassing solar systems, galaxies, superclusters, and large swaths of our universe, as we'll explore in Chapter 6. At the same time, the most fundamental driver of decentralization will remain. It's wasteful to coordinate unnecessarily over large distances. Even Stalin didn't try to regulate exactly when his citizens went to the bathroom. For super-intelligent AI, the laws of physics will place firm upper limits on transportation and communication technology, making it unlikely that the highest levels of the hierarchy would be able to micromanage everything that happens on planetary and local scales. A super-intelligent AI in the Andromeda Galaxy wouldn't be able to give you useful orders for your day-to-day decisions, given that you'd need to wait over 5 million years for your instructions. That's the round-trip time for you to exchange messages traveling at the speed of light. In the same way, the round-trip travel time for a message crossing Earth is about 0.1 second, about the timescale on which we humans think, so an Earth-sized AI brain could have truly global thoughts only about as fast as a human one. For a small AI performing one operation each billionth of a second, which is typical of today's computers, 0.1 second would feel like 4 months to you. So for it to be micromanaged by a planet-controlling AI would be as inefficient as if you asked permission for even your most trivial decisions through transatlantic letters delivered by Columbus-era ships. This physics-imposed speed limit on information transfer therefore poses an obvious challenge for any AI wishing to take over our world, let alone our universe. Before Prometheus broke out, it put very careful thought into how to avoid mind fragmentation, so that its many AI modules running on different computers around the world had goals and incentives to coordinate and act as a single unified entity. Just as the Omegas faced a control problem when they tried to keep Prometheus in check, Prometheus faced a self-control problem when it tried to ensure that none of its parts would revolt. We clearly don't yet know how large a system an AI will be able to control directly or indirectly through some sort of collaborative hierarchy, even if a fast takeoff gave it a decisive strategic advantage. In summary, the question of how a superintelligent future will be controlled is fascinatingly complex, and we clearly don't know the answer yet. Some argue that things will get more authoritarian. Others claim that it will lead to greater individual empowerment. Cyborgs and uploads. A staple of science fiction is that humans will merge with machines, either by technologically enhancing biological bodies into cyborgs, short for cybernetic organisms, or by uploading our minds into machines. In his book, The Age of M, economist Robin Hanson gives a fascinating survey of what life might be like in a world teeming with uploads, also known as emulations, nicknamed EMs. I think of an upload as the extreme end of the cyborg spectrum, where the only remaining part of the human is the software. Hollywood cyborgs range from visibly mechanical, such as the Borg from Star Trek, to androids almost indistinguishable from humans, such as the Terminators. Fictional uploads range in intelligence from human level, as in the Black Mirror episode White Christmas, to clearly superhuman, as in Transcendence. If superintelligence indeed comes about, the temptation to become cyborgs or uploads will be strong. As Hans Moravec puts it in his 1988 classic, Mind Children, long life loses much of its point if we are fated to spend it staring stupidly at ultra-intelligent machines as they try to describe their ever more spectacular discoveries in baby talk that we can understand. Indeed, the temptation of technological enhancement is already so strong that many humans have eyeglasses, hearing aids, pacemakers, and prosthetic limbs, as well as medicinal molecules circulating in their bloodstreams. Some teenagers appear to be permanently attached to their smartphones, and my wife teases me about my attachment to my laptop. One of today's most prominent cyborg proponents is Ray Kurzweil. In his book, The Singularity Is Near, he argues that the natural continuation of this trend is using nanobots, intelligent biofeedback systems, and other technology to replace first our digestive and endocrine systems, our blood and our hearts by the early 2030s, and then move on to upgrading our skeletons, skin, brains, and the rest of our bodies during the next 2 decades. He guesses that we're likely to keep the aesthetics and emotional import of human bodies, but will redesign them to rapidly change their appearance at will, both physically and in virtual reality, thanks to novel brain-computer interfaces. Moravec agrees with Kurzweil that cyborgization would go far beyond merely improving our DNA. A genetically engineered superhuman would be just a second-rate kind of robot, designed under the handicap that its construction can only be by DNA-guided protein synthesis. Further, he argues that we'll do even better by eliminating the human body entirely and uploading minds, creating a whole brain emulation in software. Such an upload can live in a virtual reality or be embodied in a robot capable of walking, flying, swimming, spacefaring, or anything else allowed by the laws of physics, unencumbered by such everyday concerns as death or limited cognitive resources. Although these ideas may sound like science fiction, they certainly don't violate any known laws of physics. So the most interesting question isn't whether they can happen, but whether they will happen, and if so, when. Some leading thinkers guess that the first human-level AGI will be an upload, and that this is how the path towards superintelligence will begin. As Bostrom has explained, the ability to simulate a leading human AI developer at a much lower cost than his, her hourly salary would enable an AI company to scale up their workforce dramatically, amassing great wealth and recursively accelerating their progress in building better computers and, ultimately, smarter minds. However, I think it's fair to say that this is currently a minority view among AI researchers and neuroscientists, most of whom guess that the quickest route to superintelligence is to bypass brain emulation and engineer it in some other way, after which we may or may not remain interested in brain emulation. After all, why should our simplest path to a new technology be the one that evolution came up with, constrained by requirements that it be self-assembling, self-repairing, and self-reproducing? Evolution optimizes strongly for energy efficiency because of limited food supply, not for ease of construction or understanding by human engineers. My wife, Maya, likes to point out that the aviation industry didn't start with mechanical birds. Indeed, when we finally figured out how to build mechanical birds in 2011, more than a century after the Wright brothers' first flight, the aviation industry showed no interest in switching to wing-flapping mechanical bird travel, even though it's more energy efficient, because our simpler, earlier solution is better suited to our travel needs. In the same way, I suspect that there are simpler ways to build human-level thinking machines than the solution evolution came up with. And even if we one day manage to replicate or upload brains, we'll end up discovering one of those simpler solutions first. It will probably draw more than the 12 watts of power that your brain uses, but its engineers won't be as obsessed about energy efficiency as evolution was. And soon enough, they'll be able to use their intelligent machines to design more energy-efficient ones. What will actually happen? The short answer is obviously that we have no idea what will happen if humanity succeeds in building human-level AGI. For this reason, we've spent this chapter exploring a broad spectrum of scenarios. I've attempted to be quite inclusive, spanning the full range of speculations I've seen or heard discussed by AI researchers and technologists. Fast takeoff, slow takeoff, no takeoff, humans, machines, cyborgs in control, one, many centers of power, etc. Some people have told me that they're sure that this or that won't happen. However, I think it's wise to be humble at this stage and acknowledge how little we know, because for each scenario discussed, I know at least one well-respected AI researcher who views it as a real possibility. As time passes and we reach certain forks in the road, we'll start to answer key questions and narrow down the options. The first big question is, will we ever create human-level AGI? The premise of this chapter is that we will, but there are AI experts who think it will never happen, at least not for hundreds of years. Time will tell. As I mentioned earlier, about half of the AI experts at our Puerto Rico conference guessed that it would happen by 2055. At a follow-up conference we organized 2 years later, this had dropped to 2047. Before any human-level AGI is created, we may start getting strong indications about whether this milestone is likely to be first met by computer engineering, mind uploading, or some unforeseen novel approach. If the computer engineering approach to AI that currently dominates the field fails to deliver AGI for centuries, this will increase the chance that uploading will get there first, as happened rather unrealistically in the movie Transcendence. If human-level AGI gets more imminent, we'll be able to make more educated guesses about the answer to the next key question. Will there be a fast takeoff, a slow takeoff, or no takeoff? As we heard, a fast takeoff makes world takeover easier, while a slow one makes an outcome with many competing players more likely. Nick Bostrom dissects this question of takeoff speed in an analysis of what he calls optimization power and recalcitrance, which are basically the amount of quality effort to make AI smarter and the difficulty of making progress, respectively. The average rate of progress clearly increases if more optimization power is brought to bear on the task and decreases if more recalcitrance is encountered. He makes arguments for why the recalcitrance might either increase or decrease as the AGI reaches and transcends human level, so keeping both options on the table is a safe bet. Turning to the optimization power, however, it's overwhelmingly likely that it will grow rapidly as the AGI transcends human level, for the reasons we heard in the Omega scenario. The main input to further optimization comes not from people, but from the machine itself, so the more capable it gets, the faster it improves, if recalcitrance stays fairly constant. For any process whose power grows at a rate proportional to its current power, the result is that its power keeps doubling at regular intervals. We call such growth exponential, and we call such processes explosions. If baby-making power grows in proportion to the size of the population, we can get a population explosion. If the creation of neutrons capable of fissioning plutonium grows in proportion to the number of such neutrons, we can get a nuclear explosion. If machine intelligence grows at a rate proportional to the current power, we can get an intelligence explosion. All such explosions are characterized by the time they take to double their power. If that time is hours or days for an intelligence explosion, as in the Omega scenario, we have a fast takeoff on our hands. This explosion timescale depends crucially on whether improving the AI requires merely new software, which can be created in a matter of seconds, minutes, or hours, or new hardware, which might require months or years. In the Omega scenario, there was a significant hardware overhang, in Bostrom's terminology. The Omegas had compensated for the low quality of their original software by vast amounts of hardware, which meant that Prometheus could perform a large number of quality doublings by improving its software alone. There was also a major content overhang in the form of much of the internet's data. Prometheus 1.0 was still not smart enough to make use of most of it, but once Prometheus's intelligence grew, the data it needed for further learning was already available without delay. The hardware and electricity costs of running the AI are crucial as well, since we won't get an intelligence explosion until the cost of doing human-level work drops below human-level hourly wages. Suppose, for example, that the first human-level AGI can be efficiently run on the Amazon cloud at a cost of $1 million per hour of human-level work produced. This AI would have great novelty value and undoubtedly make headlines, but it wouldn't undergo recursive self-improvement because it would be much cheaper to keep using humans to improve it. Suppose that these humans gradually managed to cut the cost to $100,000 per hour, $10,000 per hour, $1,000 per hour, $100 per hour, $10 per hour, and finally, $1 per hour. By the time the cost of using the computer to reprogram itself finally drops far below the cost of paying human programmers to do the same, the humans can be laid off and the optimization power greatly expanded by buying cloud computing time. This produces further cost cuts, allowing still more optimization power, and the intelligence explosion has begun. This leaves us with our final key question. Who or what will control the intelligence explosion and its aftermath? And what are their/its goals? We'll explore possible goals and outcomes in the next chapter and more deeply in Chapter 7. To sort out the control issue, we need to know both how well an AI can be controlled and how much an AI can control. In terms of what will ultimately happen, you'll currently find serious thinkers all over the map. Some contend that the default outcome is doom, while others insist that an awesome outcome is virtually guaranteed. To me, however, this query is a trick question. It's a mistake to passively ask, "What will happen?" as if it were somehow predestined. If a technologically superior alien civilization arrived tomorrow, it would indeed be appropriate to wonder what will happen as their spaceships approached, because their power would probably be so far beyond ours that we'd have no influence over the outcome. If a technologically superior AI-fueled civilization arrives because we built it, on the other hand, we humans have great influence over the outcome, influence that we exerted when we created the AI. So we should instead ask, what should happen? What future do we want? In the next chapter, we'll explore a wide spectrum of possible aftermaths of the current race toward AGI, and I'm quite curious how you'd rank them from best to worst. Only once we've thought hard about what sort of future we want will we be able to begin steering a course toward a desirable future. If we don't know what we want, we're unlikely to get it. The bottom line. If we one day succeed in building human-level AGI, this may trigger an intelligence explosion, leaving us far behind. If a group of humans manage to control an intelligence explosion, they may be able to take over the world in a matter of years. If humans fail to control an intelligence explosion, the AI itself may take over the world even faster. Whereas a rapid intelligence explosion is likely to lead to a single world power, a slow one dragging on for years or decades may be more likely to lead to a multipolar scenario with a balance of power between a large number of rather independent entities. The history of life shows itself organizing into an ever more complex hierarchy shaped by collaboration, competition, and control. Superintelligence is likely to enable coordination on ever larger cosmic scales, but it's unclear whether it will ultimately lead to more totalitarian top-down control or more individual empowerment. Cyborgs and uploads are plausible, but arguably not the fastest route to advanced machine intelligence. The climax of our current race toward AI may be either the best or the worst thing ever to happen to humanity, with a fascinating spectrum of possible outcomes that we'll explore in the next chapter. We need to start thinking hard about which outcome we prefer and how to steer in that direction, because if we don't know what we want, we're unlikely to get it. Chapter 5. Aftermath. The next 10,000 years. It is easy to imagine human thought freed from bondage to a mortal body. Belief in an afterlife is common, but it is not necessary to adopt a mystical or religious stance to accept this possibility. Computers provide a model for even the most ardent mechanist. Hans Moravec, Mind Children. I, for one, welcome our new computer overlords. Ken Jennings, upon his Jeopardy loss to IBM's Watson. Humans will become as irrelevant as cockroaches. Marshall Brain. The race toward AGI is on, and we have no idea how it will unfold. But that shouldn't stop us from thinking about what we want the aftermath to be like, because what we want will affect the outcome. What do you personally prefer and why? Please jot down your tentative answers to the following 7 questions, and then revisit them after listening to this chapter to see if you've changed your mind. Do you want there to be superintelligence? Do you want humans to still exist or to be replaced, cyborgized, uploaded, or simulated? Do you want humans or machines in control? Do you want AIs to be conscious or not? Do you want to maximize positive experiences, minimize suffering, or leave this to sort itself out? Do you want life spreading into the cosmos? Do you want a civilization striving toward a greater purpose that you sympathize with? Or are you okay with future life forms that appear content even if you view their goals as pointlessly banal? You can enter your answers at http://ageofai.org, where you can also compare notes and discuss with other readers and listeners. To help fuel such contemplation and conversation, we're going to explore a dozen future scenarios. I've chosen them not to form an exhaustive list, but to span the spectrum of possibilities. We clearly don't want to end up in the wrong endgame because of poor planning. Here's a summary of the 12 scenarios we'll consider. Libertarian utopia. Humans, cyborgs, uploads, and superintelligences coexist peacefully thanks to property rights. Benevolent dictator. Everybody knows that the AI runs society and enforces strict rules, but most people view this as a good thing. Egalitarian utopia. Humans, cyborgs, and uploads coexist peacefully thanks to property abolition and guaranteed income. Gatekeeper. A superintelligent AI is created with the goal of interfering as little as necessary to prevent the creation of another superintelligence. As a result, helper robots with slightly subhuman intelligence abound, and human-machine cyborgs exist, but technological progress is forever stymied. Protector God. Essentially omniscient and omnipotent AI maximizes human happiness by intervening only in ways that preserve our feeling of control of our own destiny and hides well enough that many humans even doubt the AI's existence. Enslaved God. A superintelligent AI is confined by humans, who use it to produce unimaginable technology and wealth that can be used for good or bad, depending on the human controllers. Conquerors. AI takes control, decides that humans are a threat, nuisance, waste of resources, and gets rid of us by a method that we don't even understand. Descendants. AIs replace humans, but give us a graceful exit, making us view them as our worthy descendants, much as parents feel happy and proud to have a child who's smarter than them, who learns from them, and then accomplishes what they could only dream of, even if they can't live to see it all. Zookeeper. An omnipotent AI keeps some humans around who feel treated like zoo animals and lament their fate. 1984. Technological progress towards superintelligence is permanently curtailed not by an AI, but by a human-led Orwellian surveillance state where certain kinds of AI research are banned. Reversion. Technological progress towards superintelligence is prevented by reverting to a pre-technological society in the style of the Amish. Self-destruction. Superintelligence is never created because humanity drives itself extinct by other means, say nuclear and/or biotech mayhem fueled by climate crisis. Libertarian utopia. Let's begin with a scenario where humans peacefully coexist with technology and in some cases merge with it, as imagined by many futurists and science fiction writers alike. Life on Earth and beyond, more on that in the next chapter, is more diverse than ever before. If you looked at satellite footage of Earth, you'd easily be able to tell apart the machine zones, mixed zones, and human-only zones. The machine zones are enormous robot-controlled factories and computing facilities devoid of biological life, aiming to put every atom to its most efficient use. Although the machine zones look monotonous and drab from the outside, they're spectacularly alive on the inside, with amazing experiences occurring in virtual worlds while colossal computations unlock secrets of our universe and develop transformative technologies. Earth hosts many superintelligent minds that compete and collaborate, and they all inhabit the machine zones. The denizens of the mixed zones are a wild and idiosyncratic mix of computers, robots, humans, and hybrids of all three. As envisioned by futurists such as Hans Moravec and Ray Kurzweil, many of the humans have technologically upgraded their bodies to cyborgs in various degrees, and some have uploaded their minds into new hardware, blurring the distinction between man and machine. Most intelligent beings lack a permanent physical form. Instead, they exist as software, capable of instantly moving between computers and manifesting themselves in the physical world through robotic bodies. Because these minds can readily duplicate themselves or merge, the population size keeps changing. Being unfettered from their physical substrate gives such beings a rather different outlook on life. They feel less individualistic because they can trivially share knowledge and experience modules with others, and they feel subjectively immortal because they can readily make backup copies of themselves. In a sense, the central entities of life aren't minds, but experiences. Exceptionally amazing experiences live on because they get continually copied and re-enjoyed by other minds, while uninteresting experiences get deleted by their owners to free up storage space for better ones. Although the majority of interactions occur in virtual environments for convenience and speed, many minds still enjoy interactions and activities using physical bodies as well. For example, uploaded versions of Hans Moravec, Ray Kurzweil, and Larry Page have a tradition of taking turns creating virtual realities and then exploring them together. But once in a while, they also enjoy flying together in the real world, embodied in avian winged robots. Some of the robots that roam the streets, skies, and lakes of the mixed zones are similarly controlled by uploaded and augmented humans, who choose to embody themselves in the mixed zones because they enjoy being around humans and each other. In the human-only zones, in contrast, machines with human-level general intelligence or above are banned, as are technologically enhanced biological organisms. Here, life isn't dramatically different from today, except that it's more affluent and convenient. Poverty has been mostly eliminated, and cures are available for most of today's diseases. The small fraction of humans who have opted to live in these zones effectively exist on a lower and more limited plane of awareness from everyone else, and have limited understanding of what their more intelligent fellow minds are doing in the other zones. However, many of them are quite happy with their lives. AI economics. The vast majority of all computations take place in the machine zones, which are mostly owned by the many competing superintelligent AIs that live there. By virtue of their superior intelligence and technology, no other entities can challenge their power. These AIs have agreed to cooperate and coordinate with each other under a libertarian governance system that has no rules except protection of private property. These property rights extend to all intelligent entities, including humans, and explain how the human-only zones came to exist. Early on, groups of humans banded together and decided that, in their zones, it was forbidden to sell property to non-humans. Because of their technology, the superintelligent AIs have ended up richer than these humans by a factor much larger than that by which Bill Gates is richer than a homeless beggar. However, people in the human-only zones are still materially better off than most people today. Their economy is rather decoupled from that of the machines, so the presence of the machines elsewhere has little effect on them except for the occasional useful technologies that they can understand and reproduce for themselves. Much as the Amish and various technology-relinquishing native tribes today have standards of living at least as good as they had in old times. It doesn't matter that the humans have nothing to sell that the machines need, since the machines need nothing in return. In the mixed sectors, the wealth difference between AIs and humans is more noticeable, resulting in land, the only human-owned product that the machines want to buy, being astronomically expensive compared to other products. Most humans who own land, therefore, ended up selling a small fraction of it to AIs in return for guaranteed basic income for them and their offspring/uploads in perpetuity. This liberated them from the need to work and freed them up to enjoy the amazing abundance of cheap machine-produced goods and services in both physical and virtual reality. As far as the machines are concerned, the mixed zones are mainly for play rather than for work. Why this may never happen. Before getting too excited about adventures we may have as cyborgs or uploads, let's consider some reasons why this scenario might never happen. First of all, there are two possible routes to enhanced humans, cyborgs and uploads. One, we figure out how to create them ourselves. Two, we build super intelligent machines that figure it out for us. If Route 1 comes through first, it could naturally lead to a world teeming with cyborgs and uploads. However, as we discussed in the last chapter, most AI researchers think that the opposite is more likely, with enhanced or digital brains being more difficult to build than clean-slate superhuman AGIs, just as mechanical birds turned out to be harder to build than airplanes. After strong machine AI is built, it's not obvious that cyborgs or uploads will ever be made. If the Neanderthals had had another 100,000 years to evolve and get smarter, things might have turned out great for them. But Homo sapiens never gave them that much time. Second, even if the scenario with cyborgs and uploads did come about, it's not clear that it would be stable and last. Why should the power balance between multiple superintelligences remain stable for millennia, rather than the AIs merging or the smartest one taking over? Moreover, why should the machines choose to respect human property rights and keep humans around, given that they don't need humans for anything and can do all human work better and cheaper themselves? Ray Kurzweil speculates that natural and enhanced humans will be protected from extermination because humans are respected by AIs for giving rise to the machines. However, as we'll discuss in Chapter 7, we must not fall into the trap of anthropomorphizing AIs and assume that they have human-like emotions of gratitude. Indeed, though we humans are imbued with a propensity toward gratitude, we don't show enough gratitude to our intellectual creator, our DNA, to abstain from thwarting its goals by using birth control. Even if we buy the assumption that the AIs will opt to respect human property rights, they can gradually get much of our land in other ways, by using some of their superintelligent persuasion powers that we explored in the last chapter, to persuade humans to sell some land for a life in luxury. In human-only sectors, they could entice humans to launch political campaigns for allowing land sales. After all, even die-hard bio-Luddites may want to sell some land to save the life of an ill child, or to gain immortality. If the humans are educated, entertained, and busy, falling birth rates may even shrink their population sizes without machine meddling, as is currently happening in Japan and Germany. This could drive humans extinct in just a few millennia. Downsides. For some of their most ardent supporters, cyborgs and uploads hold a promise of techno-bliss and life extension for all. Indeed, the prospect of getting uploaded in the future has motivated over 100 people to have their brains posthumously frozen by the Arizona-based company Alcor. If this technology arrives, however, it's far from clear that it will be available to everybody. Many of the very wealthiest would presumably use it, but who else? Even if the technology got cheaper, where would the line be drawn? Would the severely brain damaged be uploaded? Would we upload every gorilla, every ant, every plant, every bacterium? Would the future civilization act like obsessive compulsive hoarders and try to upload everything, or merely a few interesting examples of each species in the spirit of Noah's Ark? Perhaps only a few representative examples of each type of human? To the vastly more intelligent entities that would exist at that time, an uploaded human may seem about as interesting as a simulated mouse or snail would seem to us. Although we currently have the technical capability to reanimate old spreadsheet programs from the 1980s in a DOS emulator, most of us don't find this interesting enough to actually do it. Many people may dislike this libertarian utopia scenario because it allows preventable suffering. Since the only sacred principle is property rights, nothing prevents the sort of suffering that abounds in today's world from continuing in the human and mixed zones. While some people thrive, others may end up living in squalor and indentured servitude, or suffer from violence, fear, repression, or depression. For example, Marshall Brain's 2003 novel, Mana, describes how AI progress in a libertarian economic system makes most Americans unemployable and condemned to live out the rest of their lives in drab and dreary robot-operated social welfare housing projects. Much like farm animals, they're kept fed, healthy, and safe in cramped conditions where the rich never need to see them. Birth control medication in the water ensures that they don't have children, so most of the population gets phased out to leave the remaining rich with larger shares of the robot-produced wealth. In the libertarian utopia scenario, suffering need not be limited to humans. If some machines are imbued with conscious emotional experiences, then they too can suffer. For example, a vindictive psychopath could legally take an uploaded copy of his enemy and subject it to the most horrendous torture in a virtual world, creating pain of intensity and duration far beyond what's biologically possible in the real world. Benevolent dictator. Let's now explore a scenario where all these forms of suffering are absent because a single benevolent superintelligence runs the world and enforces strict rules designed to maximize its model of human happiness. This is one possible outcome of the first Omega scenario from the previous chapter, where they relinquish control to Prometheus after figuring out how to make it want a flourishing human society.